Okay, so this will be the subject. I will start with this, I will probably touch this, I will discuss a little bit that, and maybe in the end we will touch this. It depends. Okay, so first of all, I will start with some non-inflationary warm-up, just to attract your attention to some issues somehow related to inflation. Warm-up is the standard theory of spontaneous symmetry breaking, nothing less, nothing more. You have a theory like that with the simplest possible potential of this type. And suppose in the early universe, well, universe will not be relevant in this example, but suppose due to high temperature corrections or whatever, in the beginning, you were exactly placed at the phi equal to 0 point, so at the top of the potential. And here is my question to auditorium. I discussed it with some. Okay, yeah. So this field eventually will start falling down because there is a process of spontaneous symmetry breaking. So give me an educated or non-educated, whatever, guess. How long this field will oscillate until it will be stabilized at the minimum of the effective potential? Here are your parameters. This is tachyonic mass here, that is minus m squared. Lambda is a coupling constant, and that's it. And the universe doesn't expand, so there is no universe. So, I mean, anybody? Okay, so that's the first question, answer. The second, I mean, there are some parameters here, this m, lambda, whatever.
Times a negative power of
lambda
minus 4.
So lambda to the minus 4.
For time.
Okay, so the answer is it will take one oscillation, okay? The single oscillation until spontaneous symmetry breaking is realized. And that's a good, well, way of start discussing of similar stuff in inflation. And let me explain what is going on here. So here, scale field initially stays, according to the assumption, exactly at phi equal to zero.
Which you mean a Gaussian centered at phi equal to zero?
Excuse me?
By that you mean a Gaussian wave packet?
Just wait. Yeah. You gave your answer already. Okay.
The answer that you gave is not in a finite box.
Look, just wait a second. Okay, so this scale field initially, its classical part, averaged over the whole infinite universe, okay, was equal to zero. If it is in a finite box, the difference will not be very large, since we actually made computer simulations of this story in a finite-sized computer. Anyway, so this was initial value of the scale field phi. It was the scale field phi was equal to zero. So here it is phi, here is x, okay, and here are two possible minima of the potential. So it is plus m divided by square root of lambda and minus. Okay, now. At the classical level, the field just does not fall down, and in average value of the field, if you are interested in averages, and that is what many people are interested in, they study average energy, average scale field phi, whatever average. So average value of the field phi over the infinite universe will always remain equal to zero, because everything is symmetric from the beginning, and it will remain symmetric later. Now, however, spontaneous symmetry breaking still takes place. And why? That's why. Because if we start studying quantum fluctuations of the field, okay? So quantum fluctuations behave this way. It is e to the I omega t. And now what is omega? It is k squared plus m squared. But in this case, m squared is negative. So I'm writing here minus m squared. And therefore, I can, well, take I outside, minus sign outside of the square root. And I will write it plus minus. And minus is not interesting, but plus is most interesting. M squared minus k squared, I just change it them places. And what I see that for all k smaller than m, you have exponential instability. So quantum fluctuations do not oscillate, but instead of that, they exponentially grow. And that's very easy. That is this tachyonic instability. That's what people study in string theory as well when they study this Sen condensate appearance. You have a tachyonic instability of this type. There, of course, the spectrum is more complicated. Anyway, so this is how it works. And now let us look how it works. Just pick up any particular mode. Okay. So you have some sinusoidal wave, because this is in X space, it is sinusoidal wave with momentum K. So let's pick up any sinusoidal wave. And this sinusoidal wave have as equal number of plus and minus in space. And there are some nodes where this field is equal to zero. So in the places where field is equal to zero, it will always remain equal to zero because zero multiplied by exponent gives you zero. But then the amplitude of sinusoidal wave will grow exponentially. It will not oscillate, I repeat, because there is no oscillation here. Okay? But now let's think about it. You have here quantum fluctuation originally, because originally you didn't have anything but quantum fluctuations. However, the amplitude of this quantum fluctuation start growing exponentially. And this exponential growth of a given mode at the language of statistical mechanics implies that fluctuations acquire exponentially large occupation numbers. So you have like the same sinusoidal wave, but this sinusoidal wave acquires larger and larger amplitude, larger than you would expect quantum mechanically, because of this exponential instability. So you will say that I have the state corresponding to exponentially large occupation numbers. Now, in this case, I can interpret it like a semi-classical field. So what happens? I have quantum fluctuations, and then a semi-classical field grows out of these quantum fluctuations. Of course, you may ask, it's not a precise statement how it grows. It is quantum mechanical state, so it is described by a wave function of whatever. It can be here in the direction of plus, or it can be in the direction of minus. But then when you make an observation, that's the same thing like with Schrödinger cat. Before you measure the Schrödinger cat, you do not know whether it's dead or alive. At the moment when you measure it, you'll find out that in this part of the universe, this was a classical field exponentially increasing this direction, and in this part and that. And always, average value of the scalar field will remain equal to zero. Now, let's check what will be the energy of the distribution of the scalar field at the moment when the sinusoidal wave reaches the minimum of the effective potential. So minimum is at a distance m divided by square root of lambda. K should be smaller than m, so let's take k over the order of m. This means that this distance from here to here is about m minus 1. Gradient energy is the amplitude of the field phi divided by the distance. Distance is m minus 1, typical. And the amplitude of the field is m divided by square root of lambda. And the gradient energy is the square of that. If you take it, you will find out that it is m to the fourth divided by square root of lambda. And now let's compare it. Oops. M divided by lambda. And let's compare, of course. And let's compare it with what was initially. So initially you have this energy, okay? This is height of the potential. And now, yeah, thanks for correcting, but the answer was exactly that's what I wanted to get here. Okay, m to the fourth divided by lambda is exactly this energy which was staying here. So this energy after one half of an oscillation is already released to the gradient energy of the field. Okay, now of course, if these were a reversible process, if you study just one, the spring just goes this way, then it goes further and returns back exactly on the top. However, simultaneously, they're excited many different modes with many different momenta k. And as a result, what happens if you make a computer simulation, really, that the field rolls down to the left and to the right in different parts of the universe, slashes a little bit, but the amplitude of oscillations locally in every of this minimum will be much smaller than this distance from here to here. So the field will oscillate, the field distribution will oscillate here, but it will never return back. It is one oscillation, okay? Now what happens, there will be domains of the field. Here it will be negative field, here it will be positive field, here will be the main wall. So what happens in this process, the energy is transferred into the energy of the main walls, this energy is transferred into gradient energy, which is the energy of the main walls. Now, this energy of the main walls, of course, it's energetically unfavorable situation if you have these domain walls. So if you have large domains, they will start eating small domains. The number of domain walls will decrease, and the process will continue. And as a result, the size, the average size of domains will start growing. Then they will acquire exponentially, well, very large size comparable to the light size of the light cone, because eventually the speed of motion of these walls will approach the speed of light. And that is what happened. The universe will become divided into domains with plus minus m divided by square root of lambda. And this is despite, so you have spontaneous symmetry breaking in different parts of the universe despite phi average is equal to zero. So if one wants to study something which string theorists would like to do in application to cosmology, like unitary evolution of the wave function of the universe, they will see that the wave function of the universe in average does not give anything. So you must follow classical trajectories where they bring you. And if you pick up any one of these minima only, just make an observation and follow up its evolution, then the evolution of the classical trajectories will not be unitary. It will be effective reduction of the wave function. And anyway, I just wanted to show it to you as the example of, well, something which everyone should know, because this should be a part of textbook studies. We have spontaneous symmetry breaking. Everybody knows what it is. So apparently, not everybody knows that it takes one oscillation for spontaneous symmetry breaking to occur.
What's the relative time for the domain shutter versus the tunneling time, the quantum tunneling?
There is no tunneling.
Yeah, but if you include tunneling,
If I include tunneling, then tunneling can beat everything, mm-hmm. because it will be, well, could be exponentially large right. time for tunneling. The process may not even complete. Mm-hmm. Well, now let me continue this exercise. Yes?
But, I mean, there are other ways of looking for signals, but they seem to be breaking.
For what? No. Of course, you can do different things. I'm just saying that at the moment when we want to use normal language, like let's study a theory of perturbation theory near the true vacuum. So how soon this true vacuum appears and how soon this spontaneous symmetry breaking really takes place. So the domains are formed within one oscillation. And after that, domain walls start moving, etc. So the language which describes all of this at the language of semi-classical field is much more informative than the language of correlation functions, which really just does not describe the non-perturbative structure of this effect. Now let me move a little bit further, and let me consider the same effect, but taking into account inflation. Okay, that was done some time ago with our papers with Vilenkin. So this is the same story, but I would like to take into account that if I am standing here on the top of the potential, our universe is inflating. So let's see what will happen if our universe is inflating. One of the conditions for the universe to inflate in this case is that the mass of the tachyonic mass is smaller than the Hubble constant. That is what everybody now expresses in the language of the small, slower roll parameters. Anyway, M is assumed to be much smaller than Hubble constant. So here is how your fluctuations start growing. And if we do not take into account inflation, then they grow, well, approximately like that for momenta smaller than K. And momenta all the time are redshifted because the universe is expanding. So this is a good idea, except for this one is a little bit better. If you have inflation, then in fact fluctuations grow slower than this. You must take into account the friction term in the equation of motion for the fluctuations, and that will be the speed of growth, the speed of, well, spontaneous symmetry breaking. Meanwhile, space is also exponentially expanding. So here is the question, which of these two processes occur faster, and why would it be interesting? Well, because if I consider, for example, this part of sinusoidal wave near the node of the wave, near phi equal to zero. So this part exponentially grows, so this angle, so to say, tilts in this direction. This point remains here, but this distance from here to here exponentially grows like that, okay? But the distance from this point to that exponentially grows too. And it exponentially grows with this exponent, okay? So as a result, if Hubble constant is larger than m, then this stretching is faster than the growth, well, if you wish, this is y component, x component. So x grows faster than y, and therefore this angle becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. The meaning of this is the following. Even though the field tends to move in the direction of spontaneous symmetry breaking, the part of the universe where this field is still very small, close to its node, this part of the universe continue growing exponentially, and this process is no end process. Okay, that is because it's like you have a cord, and this cord at some nail, and you're stretching the cord. The cord may try to fall down, but if you're pulling the two parts away, and one point is stabilized, and it is stabilized because of topological nature of the process. If you have phi equal to zero, there is always some point. So this process was called topological inflation. So the meaning of this, the total volume of inflating topological defects, if inflation started in the topological defects, always grows exponentially. So inflation, if it begins inside a domain wall or inside a monopole, and it always begins there if the condition m is smaller than h is satisfied. Okay? So if this process starts, then you have eternally inflating topological defects. This process goes on without end. And this is the simplest, by far, example of eternal inflation. Yes?
I seem to remember that in this analysis, there was a small parameter that was required. It was not just m less than h, but
That is what it is. If you have the theory with energy density m to the fourth divided by lambda, okay? Now, this is energy density. So what is the Hubble constant here? Hubble constant squared is equal to energy density divided by M Planck squared. Okay. So now the condition is that this, my God, this thing is larger than M squared. Okay. Now, let me just rewrite it. Just wait a second. M squared divided by lambda, which is the amplitude of spontaneous symmetry breaking squared, larger than M Planck squared. So if you have a situation in this simple model where you have amplitude of spontaneous symmetry breaking larger than M Planck, then you have this defect. If you don't want to do anything about that, you may study, for example, the original new inflation model where the potential was made artificially flat. Now we can tell it, okay? Artificially flat because here it was lambda phi to the fourth logarithm phi. This was this, well, Coleman-Weinberg model. So if you have any model of type of new inflation, then this condition is satisfied. It is just in this simple model which I have shown you, this condition requires spontaneous symmetry breaking larger than M Planck. But if you have any model of spontaneous symmetry breaking which is capable of producing inflation, then you always have this eternal inflation there due to these topological defects. Okay? So here I didn't even take into account anything about quantum fluctuations or anything, it's just like that, okay? Topological inflation. Yeah.
How did you know the volume was growing?
Well, because you can even find out the analytical solution near this point, and you can find not only how it grows, but exactly how it grows. So I can show you expression it was obtained, yeah.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is that in pure de Sitter space, it's meaningless to say whether it's growing or shrinking. It's a question of slicing that's arbitrary. And in slow roll inflationary models, it's the inflaton field that picks out a slicing. It's this constant that picks out a preferred slicing. You can meaningfully say that it's expanding.
Okay.
But I thought that in all eternal inflation regimes, they're defined by the quantum fluctuations of the inflaton field being bigger than the classical roll.
No, there is no eternal inflation here. But however, nevertheless, what you can say, if you are standing near this point, okay. Yeah. then this field to the right of it and the field to the left of it is falling. So here you have phi dot is larger than zero. Okay, and therefore, this hypersurface of a given phi zero determines you, well, the preferable coordinate system in which you can measure volume. That's exactly what happens in the new inflation. In the new inflation, before you have falling, it is like De Sitter space, and all notion of expansion is meaningless. But here, around this point, say you surround it by, well, whatever part of the universe. And here at this point, phi dot is not equal to zero. And here it is not equal to zero.
Is this the classical phi dot you're talking about?
Yeah, that's a classical phi dot.
Doesn't the h squared greater than m squared guarantee that that's overwhelmed by quantum fluctuations?
It depends. It depends how far away you go. If you are very close here, then your quantum fluctuations, and that's what I will come to, overwhelm this classical rolling. If you are going further, and you just keep this part of the volume.
But that's exactly the region where you're claiming that that's the region that goes on expanding forever.
But I am, look, I am surrounding it by a box. And this box is within the realm still of Hubble constant, practically constant, because the Hubble constant near the top practically doesn't change. And this box is surrounded by the space where expansion of the universe is completely meaningful. And it is exponentially expanding, so the box inside will be also exponentially expanding. Let's probably continue it a little bit further. Okay. Now, yes.
I'm sorry. I'm just confused. This argument you gave about the amplitude of the quantum fluctuation growing exponentially and becoming classical sounds intuitively very, plausible.
Okay.
But it means this is sort of like a self-collapsing wave function or something. Is there a formalism that you can actually sort of...
Well, I must say that there is an army of people who studied exact or quasi-exact formulation of transition from quantum to classical in inflationary cosmology. And that's the basic part of it, the basic idea behind it, is this exponential growth of occupation numbers. In addition to that, if you look at how it works, people use a notion such like squeezed states, etc. And this was in many, many papers. Right now, I'm just trying to tell some basic things, and I'm afraid that I will be unable to. But the fact is that these effects of quantum fluctuations and their growth and increase, etc., this is the basis of what these people see at this in the sky right now. So let's assume that this part is correct. Nevertheless, I will remind some part of it because it will be important for us to understand some other things that follow. So how these quantum fluctuations are generated during inflation? Because what I've discussed right now is a normal method of generation of perturbations due to spontaneous symmetry breaking. In inflationary universe, if you have quantum fluctuations, then these quantum fluctuations, if their wavelength is very, very short, shorter than the size of the horizon of the universe, then they do not know anything about the curvature of the universe, the expansion, etc., so they oscillate. Once their wavelength becomes redshifted by the expansion of the universe, they start feeling expansion of the universe, and that happens because if you write down the equation for the scalar field, it contains these terms, 3h phi dot, in addition to the gradient terms here. So once these gradient terms become smaller than this one, then this one is a friction term, takes over, and the fluctuations stop oscillating. So you've written here several pages of standard derivation of how this actually happens, because instead of words, you can really quantize the scale field, solve equation for the modes, see what is phi squared, how it grows, etc. But instead of demonstrating it to you, which I would be able if I would have a little bit more time, let me just say intuitive meaning of the results which we have. So first of all, you have normal vacuum there, filled with oscillating field. Then once the oscillating field acquires wavelengths larger than h minus 1, it freezes like that. Okay? Then later it continues expanding. Its amplitude is frozen because of this friction term, but its wavelength is not. It is stretched by expansion. So its wavelength becomes larger and larger. Then on the top of this fluctuation, other fluctuations, which previously were shortwave and oscillating, they are frozen. And then this process continues, and as a result, you get an inhomogeneous distribution of a scale field, which later becomes responsible for galaxy formation. So let's just assume that the theory of this effect is correct, because yes, indeed, I can just, well, use this power of experiment to show that not only we have a theory, but okay. But one part of it that is very important for me is interpretation of this effect, because it's possible really to write down everything at the level of quantum field theory in curved space, but it is very useful to have a nice interpretation of it, because in general, quantum field theory in De Sitter space, especially for the fields with mass smaller than h, is actually very dangerous. It is infrared. In the infrared, it is more dangerous than the theory for which Wilson got his Nobel Prize. Should I explain it or not? If you have like diagrams like that, okay, for a quantum field, for example, I calculate phi squared, okay? So the diagram is like that. In quantum field theory, they are given by d4k divided by k squared. If you, instead of that, study high temperature, then there will appear some factor, temperature here, well, 2 pi, whatever, and here will be d3k divided by 2n pi temperature squared plus chi vector squared, okay? And there will be always a zero mode, n equal to zero, where you have simply three-dimensional theory, okay? So three-dimensional fluctuations in the infrared, they are much more dangerous than these ones, and that is what was the problem with the theory of phase transition. That was a problem that at one point only, you had this three-dimensional divergence. And for that, these people got this Nobel Prize to Wilson, that he knew how to work with this theory. Now, in the De Sitter space, instead of this, we have, well, Euclidean version of De Sitter space is O4 sphere, which has four periodicities, four temperatures. Therefore, instead of all integrals, you have sums. And therefore, it is like four orders of magnitude more infrared dangerous than this one. And the way how to treat this theory was exactly to study these quantum fluctuations and interpret them at the level of semi-classical field generated there all the time. So it is a strange way how you take a disadvantage of the theory, theoretical disadvantage, that you have pathologically strong infrared divergence, and say this interpretation of this pathologically strong divergence is exponentially large occupation numbers, and exponentially large occupation numbers means semi-classical field, so you should study semi-classical field and then quantum fluctuations on top of this. Yeah?
That's a massless scalar field?
Yeah, that was for the massless scalar field. If the field is massive, for example, what would be the result of calculation of this thing if the scale field is massive? If you write down expression in Euclidean space for this, the answer would be like if it will be something like temperature to the fourth, but instead of temperature to the fourth, it is Hubble to the fourth divided by m squared, and there are some pi's, okay? So if m goes to zero, then you have actual infinity. If m is not equal to zero, then you see how infrared divergent even this diagram is. And if you study any kind of diagrams or which involve interactions, then it will be just complete disaster, okay?
That's because it's all about the five coordinates. You have a symmetry. You can shift phi. Like the
sure, that's what we have, right? Exactly. I'm just trying to say that if you formally use Euclidean field theory, then you see that you must involve some interesting methods how to deal with this problem. And one of the simplest method and most powerful that was invented, that is the method of reinterpretation of this situation. Just like when you have spontaneous symmetry breaking, you can study theory assuming that you are in average sitting at phi equal to zero. And then it would be a horror exercise to get some physics result there. You may, but it will be very complicated. That's why you take one part of the universe where you fall down to the right and another part where you fall down to the left, and then you make your perturbation theory near each of these minima. So what happens here, you all the time during inflation create new and new states which are semi-classical, and then you can study quantum field theory near these states all the time. So it's like eternally repeated Schrödinger cat experiment. You make semi-classical state not once, but next h minus one time, next h minus one time, and you can study it using, well, studying unitary evolution of the wave function of the universe, and you will have it extremely spread, and then it is very difficult to get some information there. Might be possible, but very difficult. And on the other hand, you have this stochastic approach to inflation, which allows you to get a lot of information about the process using a relatively simple approach. Now, what is this simple approach? Yeah?
Those integrals are not infrared divergence.
Oh, no, no. I studied this correlator phi squared, but the infrared divergences appear in, for example, in the theory of phase transitions. They appear in the diagrams like that. I just did not want to write down here lengthy expressions involving two propagators here, or in the diagrams of more complicated type. I'm just saying that the strength of the infrared increases with the decrease of effective continuous dimensionality, okay? And for De Sitter space, you always have zero mode, where instead of all integrals, you just have this, I mean, four different sums, and inside all of these sums, you have all of this n equal to zero. So what remains here just remains m squared, if it is m squared here. And then four temperatures, which each time you have here, so they are Hawking temperatures here. Yeah, it is possible to do so, yes. Okay. Now how one can proceed with this? If on this picture, all these fluctuations added up and added up and added up, you can take one point and see at this moment, this fluctuation have added up with the amplitude plus. And the typical amplitude of the fluctuation is proportional to the only parameter which characterizes inflation, which is h. For m smaller than h, for mass much smaller than h, if one parameter, the amplitude of the fluctuation is h divided by 2 pi, if you're very accurate. And then it may be up or maybe down, up or down. So what will happen after 2 times h minus 1? H minus 1 is a typical time when the universe expands e times. During the first moment, you will have average square of the fluctuation given by h divided by 2 pi squared. During the next moment, you will have additional amplitude of this type, but you never know whether it's in direction up or in direction down. So it is exactly like with Brownian motion. If you want to find out the distance this, well, Drunk and Sadler go from the pub, you will know that it is proportional to the square root of his steps. So if you want to find out phi squared average for the massless field, you will find out that the phi squared average for the massless field is proportional to h cubed multiplied by the delta t. Delta t is the total time. And you can either calculate it exactly, I mean, well, exactly, in perturbation theory near De Sitter space for massless field, and you get this result. Or you can use this stochastic interpretation and you get the same result too. Because what is this delta t? Delta t, well, if you have h squared divided by 2 pi, h divided by 2 pi squared, multiply by the number of the steps, and number of the steps is number of e folds, and that is delta t divided by the duration of each e fold, and then it produces this result. So you have several different methods to find the same story. So why would I even spend my time of discussing, well, you can do it this way, you can do it that way, because there are situations where you cannot really do it any other way but stochastically. It's very difficult. What this tells you, that if you have a scale field with mass much smaller than h, then during every time h minus 1, you have this field push it from its original state somewhere at a distance h divided by 2 pi. However, if this field has potential energy
like that. So it is pushed in this direction, and then there is a returning force. So this amplitude of this scalar field first is pushed from the minimum. So if the field is massless, you know that it pushed around the minimum space where it was pushed to. But if it is massive, it pushed and it has a returning force. And what if the potential is like that? How you would calculate anything there? So the way to study it is, since it is Brownian motion, and it is Brownian motion in the situation where there is force acting on the particle, and force is proportional to the derivative of the effective potential. So you know how to study this. You just study the most general form of diffusion equation. In fact, this was this diffusion equation have been first derived in a complete form by Starobinsky by a completely different method. And it really was a pain to understand it. I mean, two pages with the answer, and you don't have a clue how he obtained it. But then it was possible both rederived it and also to obtain a simple interpretation of it. Because if you have any, well, you just look into the textbook on statistical mechanics. And this is probability distribution, how it depends on time with respect to the Brownian motion with a coordinate phi. It could be x, it could be whatever. In this case, it's coordinate phi. The general equation written like a d over d phi, and here is some diffusion coefficient, d, and here is some mobility coefficient. They enter this way, and they have following meaning. Mobility coefficient is very simple, or some people call it differently. If you have a particle, and x dot is equal to kf, it's like Ohm law. The current is proportional to the external field. So this coefficient is k. Now, for the case under investigation, when we can drop these phi two dots because it's inflationary regime and therefore all motions are slow. So for this case, this is our equation of motion for the classical field. So I know that k from this equation, this is external force, f. K from this equation can be calculated. It is 1 divided by 3h. Okay. And similarly, you can find expression for this diffusion coefficient because you know how the phi squared grows. And then if you know how phi squared grows, you can make some exercise. And again, I just simply do not have time for this exercise. But if anybody is interested, I can tell you how, or you can look into my book, how you can find out, I can actually show right now, d over dt of phi squared. In the limit m smaller than h squared, these jumps of the field phi are the same. So it does not matter whether it is massless field or massive with mass much smaller than h. So you know that d over d phi squared, what is the definition of that? Well, I have now my expected equation of state. Dp over dt is equal to this. Well, probably I would not really do this exercise right now. Just trust me that it can be done. And we can calculate the expression for this coefficient d, and it happens to be just h cubed. Okay? So we can arrive, and that's not a complicated exercise, we can arrive to the following form, the final form of the equation, diffusion equation for the probability distribution, to have a field phi at a given value at a given time. So it's just equation for the Brownian motion in the external field. This is external force, okay? Now, this is really returning force. dV over d phi is the force that returns the field here. And friction force does not appear here. Here it appears like 1 divided by 3h. It is this coefficient. But this is the diffusion coefficient. So you can study this diffusion equation. And, one of the simplest solutions, let's just look not for what is most physical, but what is the simplest thing. So let's assume that our universe is in kind of equilibrium state, okay? Well, it is not necessarily de Sitter, but it may be a collection of de Sitters, okay? So in this case, the probability distribution will be hopefully stationary or sometimes quasi-stationary. So let's assume that this d P over dt is equal to zero. And let's find the solutions for this equation. And the solution can be found explicitly up to sub-exponential factor, which will not matter much right now. This probability distribution to find the field at a given point, at a given time, will not actually depend on time for stationary distribution. And it will be given by this product of these two expressions. This one, in fact, really follows from solution of the equation. You just solve the equation. And this one is normalization factor. Because if you have potential like that, the main contribution to probability is given by the lowest point. Okay? So you can stay here in the lowest point, and then you can jump. And the probability of jumping will be such that it is most probably for you to be in the lowest point. So if you want the total integral of probability being equal to 1, then you better normalize it. Well, just cut off the contribution of this lowest point to normalize it. The main normalizing factor is this one. Yes?
This depends on the value of B, but not how far you have to jump and so on. And this is in
there was a condition. All the time I used the condition that m squared is smaller than h squared in the deviation, of it. So whatever it is, under the condition that inflation in slow row happens everywhere here, okay, then only derive this expression. It is possible that this expression is actually have more general validity, but that's and I suspect so. But let me, yeah.
Is there an argument why an initial rate packet actually evolves to some stationary?
Yeah, I can. Well, let's discuss it after the talk because you see, I was trying to squeeze everything that we made during the last maybe 15 years when we started studying more than that into one talk. It just would not fit. Yes?
So when you say probability is not weighed by one,
just wait. Okay. I will come to it. Okay, but now let's look at it. What is interesting about this? This is the square of the so-called tunneling wave function. This is the square of the so-called Hawking wave function. So Hawking wave function was interpreted by Hartley and Hawking as a wave function of the probability of creation of the universe. Okay? This one was interpreted by me and by Virenkin as the probability of creation of the universe. So what is then here? You see, this is a solution. That's nothing to debate. It is a solution. Okay? In a different context, though. But this is a solution, so you can check something. Now, what is the meaning of this? This is the probability to be at the given moment in this state. So it is the probability of a final, of a finite state. If you evolved from whatever, then the universe will slosh out whatever, some processes of equilibration, whatever. And in the end, you ended up in some state with this probability. So Hartley-Hawking wave function, from my perspective, should be interpreted as a probability of a final state rather than probability of initial conditions. It's just some comments in passing. It's not essential at all to what I'm talking right now. But it, at the example of this solution, you see that all of this debate, what is the Hartley-Hawking wave function, what is tunneling wave function, what is this? If you solve back, you see these stochastic equations, as my student taught me, they are called Kolmogorov equations because, well, Russian mathematician Kolmogorov studied this, and there are two different equations, backward and forward Kolmogorov equation. So there is one which tells you what will be the probability of the end point given initial conditions, and another one tells you what is the probability of initial point given the final condition. So this one is a solution of this backward Kolmogorov equation. And it tells you what is the probability that you started at some point that bring you to that. So that is a tunneling wave function which describes the probability of quantum creation of the universe. Well, forget about it. This is not that important right now. What is more important, because people in stringy community are repeatedly studying this entropy of de Sitter. So let me take a logarithm of this probability. Okay. If I take logarithm of the probability without any use of any Euclidean methods, which I consider ill-defined, then you get it. This is logarithm of probability distribution. It is entropy of not necessarily de Sitter. You may see it in a quasi-de Sitter space, and you have this expression of entropy. Now, what if you were in this point and you want to go to this point, for example, what will be the probability of this process? Well, the probability of this process is equal to this minus that. Okay? And not surprisingly, it is in fact equal to the change of e to the change of the entropy. That's completely thermodynamical expression. Okay? So you have thermodynamic interpretation of probability of tunneling if you have this quasi-thermal distribution all the time. So at each given height, you have different effective temperature, but you can tunnel. And now let's check how this probability of tunneling changes as a function of parameters in the theory. Okay? So you can, well, start with this initial expression, which I already buried here. Okay, with this expression, I combine together these two exponents with the operation of adding two expressions. I am rewriting it in this way, M Planck to the fourth. By the way, here it is M Planck is old M Planck. Okay, it's not string M Planck, it's large M Planck. And why I'm using here, I could write it in terms of string M Planck, but we are talking right now about quantum gravity fluctuations. So it is, we must pay respect to quantum gravity as well. Now, so this is a probability distribution. And suppose that the height of V of phi 0 and V of phi is approximately the same. So these two guys are the same order, and delta phi is small. Okay, so I can rewrite this then like V squared and here delta V. And I would like to check under which conditions my transition will be easy. So probability is not suppressed. And you can easily check that this happens when delta V is proportional to V squared divided by M Planck to the fourth. So if V squared is of the order of Planckian density, it's not surprising. You can easily jump from one minimum to another. Nothing suppresses these jumps. If V becomes much smaller than M Planck to the fourth, then the jumps become exponentially suppressed. But nevertheless, the probability is finite of any jump from any space, De Sitter space, to any other De Sitter space, at least under the condition that everything is smooth. If the condition is not satisfied, then I would need to give another talk about how you tunnel in a difficult situation. Okay. But if you have inflationary thing, then it's unambiguous how to describe, or more or less unambiguous. Now, what does it tell? That if you have any conditions where for a while you have nearly Planckian density and inflation, then you can really probe all kind of vacuum states. So now, can we have it? Well, let's study the theory M squared phi squared for simplicity, okay? And let's check, and now I'm starting studying what I called eternal inflation in chaotic inflation scenario. So let's study this simplest model and see how the scale field evolves in this scenario. And for this scenario, the questions which Raphael asked will be much more appropriate. Okay, so let's study this, and let us study two different processes. The first process is classical rolling of the scale field described by this equation. And in this equation, during inflation, you can forget about these phi 2 dots terms. And another is quantum jumps. So let's compare relative importance of these two processes. So classical motion, according to this equation, shows you that scale field rolls down with this speed. Hubble constant is proportional to the square root of effective potential divided by M Planck. And now in this model where effective potential is M squared phi squared, it will be M phi divided by M Planck. During the time delta T, which is equal to H minus 1, the change of the field will be its velocity multiplied by this h minus 1. And you can find out that this change of the field will be M Planck squared divided by phi. So the larger value of the field phi, the smaller is the change of the field during this Hubble time. Now, as for the quantum fluctuations, delta phi quantum is proportional to h divided by 2 pi, and h is square root of energy, so it is proportional to the scale of field phi. So if field phi grows, then this part, delta phi, becomes large, and this one becomes small.
So at some, in some regime, and you can find out where it is still much below the Planckian density in all of this area where scale of field phi is larger than some particular value. Your average rolling will be very, very small, and your amplitude of jumps will be very, very large.
Andre, the two jumps stay different in delta t, right?
Excuse me?
Quantum motion goes like square root of delta t. And the plasma
I am, like no, delta t. No, 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 right now I'm stuck. Right now,
can you
I'm.
Finish?
What?
Please let me finish.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
So I wonder if what you find is simply that at short times the quantum fluctuations dominate, but at long times somehow the classical motion takes over.
Just watch. Okay. So what I am finding out right now is the following: that let's consider the moment h minus one, because I will take some picture, prepare it for this purpose, okay? And this picture will be very gray because I'm
that it was in the quantum phase.
Look here. Assume that you are the value of the field phi larger than this, so that during the single time h minus one, the amplitude of jump is larger than the amplitude of the decrease. So you can, more or less forget about the decrease. It's just like you have simply jumps and jumps, as if you have flat potential, okay? So let's look at the initial domain of a size, for example, h minus one, which is a separate sub-universe, because any observer sitting here would not know anything that happens beyond this horizon. Now, in this state, you have the value of the scale field, which was phi zero. So classically, after the time h minus one, this field just moved a little bit down, okay? But we said that amplitude of quantum fluctuations is much larger. So that is what I'm showing. The domain became e times larger. And in this domain, the scale field in half of it jumped up, in half of it, it jumped down. And the overall decrease of the field can be forgotten. This is a small effect at this small stage right now, during this time, h minus one. So during this time, h minus one, our universe becomes divided into parts. One part where the scale field is larger, another part where the scale field is smaller. Now, what is the volume of this part, though? Because you started with a domain of the size h minus one. During the time h minus one, the volume, the size will grow e times, the volume will grow e cubed, which is approximately 20 times. And then this means that in 10 original volume domains, you will have scale of field larger than it was before. In 10 other domains, it will be smaller than it was before. So let's forget about these 10 other domains. Let's concentrate on these 10, and let us repeat the exercise, okay? Then in these domains, after time h minus one, you will have the volume which is 100 times larger than original domain, and at this 100 times, scale field will be even larger than it was before. So yes, if you consider any given point, and you study how this phi squared moves in any given point, then eventually this drifting down prevails, okay? But if you take into account that in those places where you jump higher, you're rewarded by faster growing volume, then you will say, let me calculate, maybe that's a winning game, okay? And the statement is the following, that if you are above this limit, M Planck divided by this value, then you indeed are in a winning situation. Because every jump h minus one, your total volume of space that has larger value of the scale of field phi becomes larger than it was before. You started with one domain, then it's 10, then it's 100, then it's 1,000. So that is what I call,
I probably asked this 100 years ago in Foucault. If I were to allow terms like scale of field times square root of g times scale of curvature, the effective Planck mass for those large value of phi would be enormous.
No.
Am I supposed to forbid these terms?
The effective,
if I add a term phi square root of g r,
if you add to the theory terms like that, then you would not have inflation in the first place.
So yeah. I have to forbid this by decree.
Yes. Right.
Yeah. Can I re-ask my question?
Okay, yeah, should. Yeah.
So why do you say that this volume is expanding when you don't have a good slicing that picks up?
I do not know what you're calling a good slicing, because certainly in the vicinity of what is going on here, it is locally a piece of De Sitter space. It is not exactly a piece of De Sitter space. There is average speed of the scale field down. So there is certainly a violation of De Sitter invariance here. Whether this violation is strong enough or not strong enough, it's a different issue. But it is definitely not a De Sitter space. I definitely cannot make a transition to De Sitter space which will eliminate average drift down. So whether it is small effect or not small effect, there is no return to De Sitter space and to statement there is no expansion there.
What is wrong with using the opposite sign of H and saying that this is an anti-friction term and still the guy goes down?
No, just a second. Here H is positive. He asks something else. Yeah. Here is a tricky situation. Let me explain what exactly is tricky here. If I will try to find out if I would like to find out the position of this point and calculate, for example, delta rho over rho right now, corresponding to the point where this eternal inflation happens, okay? So this phi greater than some limit. So what I will find out that this delta rho over rho is large. So if I would like to have one generic coordinate system where I study all this stuff, and why it is so? Because expression for delta rho over rho involves phi dot. So if I'm going to a place where phi dot is extremely small, then I have uncontrollable situation. So from the point of view of an observer sitting later in the Friedman universe formed by that, I will be unable to describe it by a single piece of Friedman universe, which is locally Friedman. And the interpretation of this is very simple. Indeed, what happens is that I have a part of space, and some part of space is still jumping somewhere near, V of phi, which could be comparable with Planck density, and some part of it already went down to V of phi of the order of 10 to the minus 120, as now. So because of self-reproduction, you have some parts which are still upstairs, some parts which are downstairs. So you cannot use your perturbation theory in the final state to describe the geometry of the universe homogeneous space, because the universe becomes a fractal. You do not describe a fractal like an approximately sphere, okay? So that's the issue here. Meanwhile, if you are still during inflation and you calculate delta rho over rho during inflation, then during inflation, delta rho over rho will be given by delta V over V in this process. Phi dot will have no relation to it. And this quantity will be much smaller than 1 for V much smaller than M Planck to the fourth. So the local study of the process at every moment of a jump, local study of the process is completely legitimate. The question is, however, what will global interpretation of it from the point of view of an observer sitting, later in what will be later produced? And the answer is that you do not do it this way. You really understand that you are dealing with a fractal, so you should approach this process with all respect to fractal geometry instead of trying to study it like whether this is exponentially expanding Friedman. So it's a partial answer to his question, not a complete answer, I would say. Now, how do you study it formally, whether there is a formalism of studying this thing? Because the previous equation.
You probably have a lot more to say, and there's a lot of questions. Should we try to plan on a break and a continuation, or are you really close?
It's up to you.
We're nowhere near the end of the principle yet. So.
What?
How much longer do you think allowing for lots of questions?
How much longer can I go?
Right. I don't want to give you
No. I will summarize something in 5 minutes, and then you may decide whether you want to hear more about it or not some later stage. Okay. So you can study everything with diffusion equations which I have written, but these diffusion equations describe your processes at a given point. If you want to take into account that some parts of this volume have greater, importance because there the speed of expansion is larger, then you should modify these equations by adding to the equation, a term which is responsible for different rate of expansion in different parts of the universe. And then you solve these kind of equations. And if you do so, you will find out something which you will not find out if you study diffusion equations in a given point for realistic theories. You will find out a truly stationary distribution. Because the stationary distribution which I've shown you, it is valid only assuming that you have a de Sitter minimum. And this de Sitter minimum with Hubble constant larger than masses there. And that's not the game which we are playing. Well, it may be still okay to use this expression. And that was an assumption of Lenny Susskind, who studied this probability of having this stringy landscape and this tiny temperature of the present de Sitter may bring you back to the top of it. Well, what we can have during this eternal inflation, you can spend a lot of time near the wall, or you can spend a lot of time near the top of a potential in a new inflationary type potential. So you can spend a lot of time at high Hawking temperature. And because of that, you produce new parts, or you jump from one part of the stringy landscape to another part of it much easier than when you sit right now and try to jump from the present low temperature state to a different state. So you can use both mechanisms. If you have eternal inflation, then it is much easier for you to jump in a different way, not from the present state. And what is interesting about it, that sometimes you can find stationary distributions of living in different parts of the universe with different properties. And just to show that we really worked on it, not just, this is one of the solutions, okay? And then, of course, if you look at the solution, you understand it better, you just. This is a probability distribution to find yourself at a given point, phi, at a given time, starting from initial point, chi. And sometimes it.
Solution of this new equation?
Solution of this new equation, yeah.
Where H depends on phi.
It depends on phi, and you take into account the fact that the volume, the part of the space with large V expands faster.
Okay. But that's built.
It is a station.
That was that extra term.
Excuse me?
That was that extra term, 3HP.
This extra term. So with this extra term, you can obtain something which you can study, but this is really a mess. So what you can do computer simulations, you can solve equations numerically on Mathematica, so this expression.
This depends on the slicing choice, right?
Yeah. Yes.
How is it an invariant statement?
I do not make any invariant statement so far.
Maybe I can choose a different slicing in which everything collapses.
Yes, you may. Yes. So, shall we make a break at this point? No. No. Here is the situation. I should give you an example. You know what's complicated with having friends, you know? Friends know everything about you. Enemies don't, okay? So sometimes friends, they ask the questions which enemies would not. Now here is eternally inflating universe which contains infinite amount of space. Now, this space can be, say you have a field which can sit in one minimum, in this stringy or non-stringy landscape in another minimum, say, what is the probability for you to live in this minimum as compared to this one? And I would ask, what is the probability to leave when? Okay. And then the question when brings us to general idea. You would say that I can define time this time way, that way, and some other way. And then some other people will come with their own probability distribution, like there was Vilenkin probability distribution number one, number two. There are several different measures which can be used here. And I will just illustrate the problem which appears here. Suppose, and this is not related to eternal inflation, this is just a picture. You have a cone, which kind of like light cone, just cone, okay? So, and I will paint one half of this cone with white and another is black. So with this cone, the fraction which is white, is it 50%? Right, it's 50%, right? Let me cut it this way, okay? And I will have here twice as much white in this cut than black. And in the next slide, because it's parallel, the same property, it will be twice as large than black. So if I cut it this way, I will find that actually two-thirds of the cone is white. So if I want really to determine, to find here an invariant measure, I will have the same problem as the one which I have when I compare the number of rational numbers to the number of integers. Comparison of infinities is a dirty job. What is important, however, that we have infinities, okay? That is invariant. So if I say that my universe contains an infinite volume of red and an infinite volume of black, and this volume is growing in whatever normal definition of time you can suggest, then that's what I call eternal inflation. And that, this is something which may be at least partially invariant in whatever definitions you want. So I would say that infinity, this is what we're having here, and that's sufficiently large.
To make an infinite set
finite. Oh, yeah. If you will make such a cut that will be unable to cover the whole geometry, then you will be... Because you can invent such a time that will start bending and bending like that, and then it will never cover infinite space. So you can do it, but this will be just incomplete map.
The number of integers weighted by 1 over n squared.
Okay, so returning to anthropic principle. Yes.
Yeah. So, well, thank you now. Come back here.
3:45. Oh, you mean continue?
Yeah. No, sure.
Come back.